I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about Indie Food Drop, a new initiative that aims to save tons of food and deliver it to those who need it the most. We'll talk about how Indie Food Drop got started and how it works. My guests are Kate Howe from Indie Hunger Network, Jennifer Vigren from Second Helpings, and John Whitaker from Midwest Food Bank. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today on No Limits about Indie Food Drop. It's a new initiative designed to move undeliverable foodstuffs onto those who need it the most. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Kate Howe from Indie Hunger Network, Jennifer Vigren from Second Helpings, and John Whitaker from Midwest Food Bank. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And I guess with Jennifer, it's welcome back since she's been on the show before.
Thank you so much.
Certainly. It's good to have you back here. So I'm going to start with Kate on this one. Let's talk first about what Indie Food Drop is.
The idea is that we created a new website to connect with truckers and give them information about where they can donate food. This is already happening, but we want to give truckers an easier way to get to the places that can use those foodstuffs that are not able to get to their destination for whatever reason.
And is the website live now?
It is live. So it's indiefooddrop.org. We have actually several URLs, but we are directing people to that one. And anyone can go there. They can find out where they can donate, what times of day, who to contact, what items are accepted, and what quantities as well.
Are truckers, and I'll throw this one to John, since before we went on the air, everyone informed me that John was the one who had the contacts among the truckers. Are truckers the primary place where you can get these foodstuffs that otherwise wouldn't be used?
Yes, over a million trucks a day go through Indiana, and that's just phenomenal. Of course, we are the crossroads of America, so that is our main source. But they also go to DCs, distribution mm-hmm. centers, and so there is a market at distribution centers. That's where these loads would be rejected by the distribution center and then sent off to a secondary supplier. And if not, the trucker has this load on his truck that every day he's not rolling, he's losing about $1,000. So there's a real emphasis on the trucker for sure, but also on the DC for allowing an option for them that's beneficial for the trucker and also for the company that's rejecting the load.
And why would the distribution center reject the load?
We know in America we love perfect produce, John. Mm-hmm. It's you go to the market and you see this beautiful polished apple. You see cucumbers that are straight and perfect, or a romaine lettuce that doesn't have curved leaves. And we're pretty picky about what we pick up at the market. And produce doesn't always grow that way, as well as other items that are perishables. For example, several months ago we received a truckload of romaine lettuce in a three-count bag. And I asked the driver, why was this rejected? It was almost 32,000 pounds of romaine lettuce. And he says, well, when we got to the distribution center, they told me that when they checked the first few pallets of this product, that the stems grew crooked rather than straight. So they rejected the entire load. And so it goes to that extreme. For example, when you buy a cantaloupe, They're packaged in an 8-count case. If that cantaloupe doesn't fit through a hoop for sizing properly, then that entire load's rejected because it's just not quite the right size. And so it can be as much as a blemish or on an onion. We just received our first load, really, of onions from this program, and 14 pallets of yellow onions in 50-pound bags. And they had a little bit of a green, you know, an onion has a little bit of a green stem at the end of it. It was a little longer than it should have been for them, and they were rejected. So this trucker has this on his truck, and he's got to get that to the next his truck to the next location, or he's losing money. Calls his dispatcher, and his dispatcher just tries as quickly as she can to find a place to offload this product or to resell it. If they can't, then in the past it's gone to the dump.
Okay, and what you're saying is rather than have it go to the dump, it comes to you folks. Jennifer, while John was talking, you were shaking your head and chuckling. How common is this?
This is common. Now, fortunately, from a trucker's perspective, they're not knowingly going to bring product that they know isn't going to meet specifications.
Oh, yeah,
but it still happens.
Massive waste of time for
absolutely,
them.
Absolutely, and a massive waste of money. That being said, this happens in our grocery stores every day. We are the consumers. We're the ones who are really responsible, ultimately, for this decision-making that the romaine lettuce has to grow straight and the onions can't have a long green stem on them. It's because when you and I go to the grocery store, we are selecting the product. And it is that pickiness that we have. We like our apples bright and red and shiny. And in the end, it has absolutely nothing to do with the nutritional value, what it tastes like. It's this aesthetic that we've developed. And as a result, there's a huge amount of waste in our system. And it's not just at the trucker level. It's throughout the entire system.
Is there, and I'll throw this one to Jennifer first, but anyway, do we have any, can we quantify that? Have there been studies that show, well, I see Kate nodding her head, but Jennifer, do you have the answer? You want me to go to Kate?
Either. Well, I can tell you that USDA did a study several years ago and found that about 31% of the food that goes through retail and consumers is wasted. And most of it happens at the consumer level. So if you think about 31% of the food that comes to our grocery stores ultimately is not consumed by us, we actually waste that food.
So you're saying that this occurs even after the trucker.
Even after the trucker.
Once it goes to the grocery store, it's the stuff we throw out because we didn't eat it, you know. We got too big a portion, or, you know, we left it in the fridge for too long, or whatever. So 31%. How you know, in terms of pounds, tons, calories, whatever you want to go with, how much is that? I just want to get a sense, John.
According to the USDA, over 133 billion pounds of food was thrown away last year.
133 billion pounds of food. Okay.
Kind of hard to wrap your head around that, isn't it?
Well, I'm leaving it out there because I want to let it sink in. That's obviously because we're a large country. That's food that would feed a lot of other countries along the way. Is there Kate, I'll bring it back to you. Are there particular kinds of food that are more likely to be thrown away? I mean, we've talked an awful lot about produce, but is that the most common?
I'd say produce really is the most likely to be thrown away because the shelf life is much shorter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another reason that food might be rejected. If a driver brings bananas that are too ripe, they won't have as long a shelf life, so the grocery store is less likely to be able to sell them before they go bad. And so those are an item that we see a lot coming to food banks is donated bananas that are just they look beautiful when they arrive, but they might not last 2 weeks or a full week.
They get a little mottled afterwards.
And then no one wants to buy them, right? So I'd say produce is by far the biggest quantity of food thrown away, but you know, there are meats and other items that expire that just sit on shelves until they need to be dumped as well.
Yes,
dairy is actually it's fruits, vegetables, and dairy.
Okay.
Those three categories make up more than half of the food that's wasted.
Is that because of the expiration dates? Yeah, they're short. We are talking about Indy Food Drop on No Limits today. That's a new initiative to move undeliverable foodstuffs onto those who need the food the most. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So, John, I'm going to start with you on this one then. We've got Indy Food Drop in place with the URL. How much food do you hope to divert by using this so that it's not going to the dump and it's going into people's bellies?
Well, instead. You know what's really beautiful about this project, this pilot project, is our ROI is one semi-full. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to scale it up is going to be beautiful. But we think that we can glean about 30 semis a month from this program, so one a day. Because of the sheer volume that goes through our state, you know, and it's not only that these trucks are rejected at local mm-hmm. distribution centers, is the mechanical problems on the way there, mm-hmm. even in states away from us. So, for instance, a trucker has a refrigeration unit on his truck that starts to act up a little bit. We've had truckers that have set the temperature 1 degree too high, so that means that on a normal truckload of head lettuce, and we've had this happen before, the last two pallets, the outer leaves are frozen, but the rest of the pallets are fine. Well, when they get to a DC, you know, they're going to be rejected. So that truck already knows when he opens it up at his truck stop before he makes a delivery that they're going to reject that. So he's already calling his dispatcher. Like, mm-hmm. I'm rolling through Indiana. Is there a place that I can drop this food? And, of course, we've allowed them to have that place to do that with Indy Food Drop.
Okay. Do they get and I want to follow up on all of this, but a procedural question. I mean, the company presumably that owns the produce, do they get a charitable contribution for doing this, a tax deductible thing? Everyone's nodding his head. We actually need words on radio, guy.
yes, okay. They do. You know, okay. We give okay. them. They can even take part of their operating expense to get it to that point as a charitable gift.
So it's a way to write off the loss at some level, too. So it makes business sense. It's not simply philanthropic in their case. So you're thinking 30 semis a month. Because we let that massive billion-pound figure hang out there, how many pounds of food would that be in a single semi?
A typical semi of produce, depending on what the item is, but it's around 30 to 40,000 pounds.
30 to 40,000 pounds. So if you're multiplying, we'll just take the number 30. We're talking about somewhere between, that's more than 1 million pounds, right, a month.
Yes.
Somewhere around the 900 to 900,000 to 1.2 million, right?
And generally produce per pound is a little over $2 a pound.
Okay.
On the wholesale market.
Okay, so we're talking about over the course of a year, somewhere between $24 and $30 million then,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's correct.
Okay, so how many people will that feed, Jennifer?
Wow. So we're looking at 1 million pounds of food?
Mm-hmm.
Think about just if you figure a meal is about a pound of food. That's a huge number of people who can be impacted. And what's really important here is it's not just the number of pounds, it's what this product is. This is that good, nutritious produce mm-hmm. that is so hard for us to capture in our pantries and in our food banks. This, for the people in our community who may not have what they need, it's actually really good nutrition. It's not empty calories. So it's not just the quantity of the food. It's the quality of the products that we're bringing in. It's that good, fresh produce, the kind of healthy food we want to see.
So who, once you captured this 1 million pounds of food every month, so that works out to about 12 million pounds over the course of a year, where does it go? I mean, how are you... You know, I'm assuming just having it dropped at a spot does not end the story. You don't force the hungry people to come to it. You're trying to get it to them. Kate?
So for Food Drop, we've identified four locations around the city where truck drivers can drop off food. So one of them is Midwest Food Bank. One is Second Helpings. There's also Gleaners Food Bank on the south side and the St. Vincent de Paul Food Pantry. So obviously St. Vincent de Paul is giving that food out right away. Second Helpings is turning it into hot meals that they serve around the community. And then the food banks are giving that to local food pantries throughout the city. So there are about 200 food pantries throughout Marion County that are distributing that produce that comes from the trucker to the food bank and then on to the food pantry.
How quickly do you have to, and I know we're coming up on a break, so I'm going to try to, we may have to pick this up on the other side. I'll tell you what, we will pick it up on the other side, because I think the logistics of this are likely to be fascinating to people. We are talking today on No Limits about Indy Food Drop. It's a new initiative to move undeliverable foodstuffs onto the people who need the food the most. My guests are Kate Howe from Indy Hunger Network, Jennifer Vigren from Second Helpings, and John Whitaker from Midwest Food Bank. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about Indy Food Drop. It's a new initiative designed to move undeliverable foodstuffs on to the people who need the food the most, the hungry. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Kate Howe from Indy Hunger Network, Jennifer Vigren from Second Helpings, and John Whitaker from Midwest Food Bank. Before we went to the break, Kate, we sort of left the story halfway told here. We were talking about where the food comes from these truckers. But as you were explaining it, it's become clear, you know, just getting the truckers to drop the food off doesn't solve the problem. You've right. got to move it out from those places. How much have you had to ramp up operations to get, you know, what amounts to 12 million pounds of food that you didn't have before over the course of a year out to the people who need it?
It's definitely a challenge, and one of the things that Indy Hunger Network has done is to provide grants to food pantries to help them buy additional equipment and be able to store fresh foods, to expand their space to just have greater capacity to serve more people and to provide more food. So thanks to a donation from Dow AgroSciences, we've been giving out grants to food pantries in Marion County and surrounding counties for, I think, 4 years now. And we still have more work to do. We continue to work with food pantries, and we're starting to work with small food pantries. Some of them are what we call pantry partners, serve, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 families a week. Some of the smaller food pantries are only open once a month, but they may be places where we can look for growth and get some of that additional food out into the system.
Well, I presumably you talk about Dow. I mean, how much does this increase the budget? Because you have to hire more people, presumably, to get this out. I mean, there's a cost to this.
No, that's the beautiful thing about not-for-profits is we have this wonderful group of volunteers that help us. At our location at the Midwest Food Bank, we have 6 employees, but you have over 3,000 volunteers. So on a budget of $700,000 last year, we passed out $30 million worth of food with the help of these volunteers. And so the hands and feet are there. And so as you scale things up like this, what's beautiful is we have this network of partnerships that help. And we were talking earlier before the break about how do you get this food out? Well, you know, it comes in all hours of the day. And so it may come in at 2 o'clock in the morning. And so what's really beautiful is partners like Sysco, one of the largest food distributors in the world, has stepped up and said, We know that you guys go in the middle of the night to receive this food that's coming off of these distributions, and we want to partner with you, and I want you to know that we will take those loads for you overnight, and you can come pick them up the next morning. So 24 hours a day we have access to receiving this product. And then how it's distributed, John, is through a food bank. Mm-hmm. We have 320 faith-based and social service organizations that come to our location at varying times through the month. We also have 3 remote distribution sites where we distribute this food. So there's this beautiful, you know, I was 30 years in retail grocery, so this beautiful network of distribution that we have, the hub and spoke kind of model. So the larger food banks are distributing this food to pantries and agencies all across. We're in 60 counties in the state, feeding over 80 to 90,000 people every month.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about Indy Food Drop. It's a new initiative designed to move undeliverable food to people who really need it the most in our community, the hungry. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Ben has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Ben writes, I originally lived in Chicago and used to frequent a produce store called Stanley's Fruit Market. While lots of its produce was fresh and met any major grocery store chain standards, they also had produce that did not meet those standards. As an example, they might sell large red peppers that suffered the same blight, which left a small black mark on the bottom of the pepper. It was completely benign. It could be easily cut off and discarded, and as a result of this imperfection, they sold for 10 cents each, whereas an unblemished pepper might sell at a dollar each. Or they might sell blueberries that were close to expiration. A couple blueberries in the middle of a pint box might have mold starting to form, but they could easily be separated while the rest were washed. Stanley's would sell 12 pints at a cost of $3. Why aren't there more places like this in Indianapolis? Is it simply that no one has stepped up? Jennifer.
Well, here's the good news, Ben. That food is actually still staying in the food system. What's happening throughout Indianapolis is those grocers are donating that food to places like Second Helpings or Gleaners or Midwest Food Bank, where at Second Helpings, our volunteers are sorting through those blueberries and sorting through those peppers, cutting off that black end perhaps, and using it to prepare hot, nutritious meals for people throughout our city. So we've been very successful about capturing that food. It isn't necessarily being sold, but it is staying in our food system and helping those who need it most.
I mean, how many people are we attempting to help here? I mean, do we have numbers in central Indiana as to how many people are hungry and how do we define hunger? I'll start with Kate on that one.
Well, that's I don't know where to start. I guess
I know. Big question.
In Marion County, one in five.
That's why we call it No Limits.
Right. In Marion County, one in five people are food insecure. And that means that they don't always know where their next meal will come from. Sometimes they might miss a meal. Sometimes they might have enough to eat, but it's of compromised nutritional quality. They go to the convenience store and buy a bag of chips because that's what they can afford that day or that's what they can get to. They may have transportation issues with accessing food. And so, you know, one in five people in Marion County equates to about 200,000 people right here in our community. And across the state, it's close to a million hungry people in Indiana. So it's a sizable problem. And we're not seeing, you know, the level of famine you might imagine, you know, what you see abroad on the news. But we are seeing people who are having impacts from hunger. So kids are less able to learn. It's harder to hold a job. Crime is tied to hunger. There are a lot of other social issues that are partly impacted by the fact that if you don't have a good meal, that's your main focus. You're not going to focus on anything else until you've gotten the food that you need.
John, who are these folks who are part of our community who are food insecure or hungry?
I'm so glad you asked that question, John. You know, unfortunately, it's the most vulnerable in our society. So 21% of the people in our state that are food insecure are children. Over 340,000 children in our state are going to wake up tomorrow and they're going to say, am I going to have adequate food? Is my mom and my dad or my parent going to be able to supply me with food? The second largest growing number are the elderly that have to choose each day between a medication and a meal. And then you have what we call situational poverty, a moving target. So in southern Indiana, I was just at Todd's Transitional Housing in Seymour, 68 men in the grips of heroin addiction, so the opiate problem. Puts another spin on the need. So that represents 68 families in our state who one of the parents is in this addiction and causes the rest of the family to have to suffer and wonder where they're going to get their next meal. So the wife in that family has to go to work. Maybe there's three children involved. So you've just got a compounded problem. And then a large growing group in our community, of course, is what we call the working poor. Mm-hmm. Those that have been downsized have had an event in their life with in their job situation that have caused them to take a lower paying job, and they can pay their bills but can't put nutritious food on their table.
Jennifer, I was watching you while I was talking about that. I mean, what was going through your head?
I'm always, every time we talk about it, and we talk about the very personal impacts that hunger has on people. It's not, it, you know, we can talk about the big numbers, and we can talk about hundreds of thousands of people and millions of people, but, you know, it's when you get down to an individual person. And that child and that senior and that parent, what it must be like to be that parent who knows that you cannot provide for your child and that your child goes to bed hungry. And that's a real issue in our city. The Boys and Girls Clubs have talked to their – when you talk to the kids who go to those clubs about how often do you go to bed hungry at night, I mean, the thought that you have to ask a child that question – it's just heartbreaking to me. But knowing that we have the ability to address at least some of this and, you know, in incremental ways to help make sure that kids get hot, nutritious meals after school, because you can't do your homework if you're focused on the fact that you're hungry and you don't know if you're going to eat that night. We had one partner agency, the Mary Rigg Neighborhood Center, who went to the children they serve. It's a neighborhood with 90% poverty. And they said, if there was one thing we could do as an organization to help you be more successful in school, what would you like? They didn't ask for calculators. They didn't ask for computers. They said, can we have dinner? This is something that is so personal, but it's also so important for us as a society, because this is our future. These children are our future workforce. They are our future leaders, and we owe them something better than what they're getting.
I want to say to our listeners, if you want to join this conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. And I hear actually what Jennifer is saying, that each one of these is an individual tragedy that has very human consequences. And I don't want to diminish that by attempting to quantify, but at some level I want to get some sense of whether this is a problem that we are making inroads in terms of dealing with, or if we're actually seeing the numbers of hungry people in our state go up. Kate?
It's really a moving target. And, you know, the nonprofit hunger relief organizations are a part of the puzzle, but a really big part of it is the federal nutrition programs. Mm-hmm. So SNAP, also known as food stamps, WIC, senior benefits, school meals. There are a variety of federal nutrition programs that help feed hungry people. And what we're trying to do with our nonprofit efforts is to fill that gap between what's provided by the government and the meals that are still needed. And every time there's a change to government programs, that changes the target for us. So if the SNAP food stamp program is cut, or if school meals are cut, then that means more people we need to provide meals for. And we actually the Indy Hunger Network did a study a few years ago, which we called the Unmet Need Study. And we actually did a telephone survey through the Rutgers Survey Center to find out how many people actually are hungry. And what we found was that about 21% of people reported need, which follows what the USDA statistics tell us as well. And of those people that reported need, 6% of the people that were reporting need said that their need was not entirely met by the services available to them, either through federal programs or through nonprofit hunger relief. And so that's the gap we've been trying to fill, is that 6% of people who still aren't getting all the food that they need, even with all of the things that we're doing, all of the programs that are available, they're still not getting all the food that they need. We just completed a second study in February. We don't have the data yet, so I don't have new numbers to report, but we are actually actively trying to track the change to see, you know, has that number gone up? Has it gone down? do we need to adjust the work that we're doing to try to meet a new gap?
So let me ask this. Because we've talked about primarily about the not-for-profit sector's response to this problem, but Kate just alluded to government support. In the budget that the president proposed, obviously Meals on Wheels became the poster child for a lot of, but there were cuts in a lot of other programs. Some of them weren't just cuts, they were eliminations,
right,
including some of the areas you're talking about. If that happens, I'm going to start first by talking about, you've built a network here. Is your network adequate to step into that gap? Yeah, John's reaction's immediate and emphatic, so I'll go with him first, but I want to hear everyone's thoughts.
You know, there's no way. We are the safety net. And so after the government programs, there's still people, some who don't qualify but yet still have a very real need. But we aren't prepared in the state of Indiana, and I think probably across the country, if these federal programs are drastically cut, $30 million that we pass out here in Indiana is a drop in the bucket to what, 70%, I think, is it, Jennifer, of folks, well, maybe it's closer to...
You mean 90%?
90%,
yes,
yeah. 90% of the folks that are fed across America are fed through these government programs. We pick up the slack.
Jennifer, you got the cue there. So, how much would your efforts have to be ramped up to fill the gap if those?
Basically? Yes. So in Indianapolis, we took a look at how hunger relief is distributed in the city and in Marion County. And we looked at how many meals are going through SNAP, how many go through WIC, the program that serves women, infants, and children, how many go through school meals for children eligible for free and reduced lunch, summer meals, all of these programs. And then we looked at what our charitable sector does, and we were 10%. The charitable sector is 10%, but a critical 10%. We fill in the gaps where those programs aren't adequate to meet people's needs.
Kate, in terms of how much would you have to, how many people would you have to recruit even to deal with, that sort of increased demand on your services?
Obviously it depends on how much the budget gets cut and in what areas, but truly, we there's no way we can move quickly enough to meet a major cut in these programs. We saw just last year that there was a drop in Marion County in SNAP participation by 14% because of some new rules that were implemented. And we're now, that's part of why we're re-examining the unmet need in our county to see if that change has meant there are more hungry people. And so we're already dealing with reductions in participation in the federal programs. And I just don't think we can mobilize quickly enough to fill the role that the government programs have been filling so successfully for so many years.
And, John, it's not just the food programs. It's also the after-school programs and the programs that are delivering the services, the food services to the children.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Indy Food Drop. It's a new initiative to move undeliverable foodstuffs onto those who need the food the most. But really, we're now talking about hunger, and hunger in Indiana, hunger in America. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Kate Howe from Indy Hunger Network, Jennifer Vigren from Second Helpings, and John Whitaker from Midwest Food Bank. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about Indie Food Drop. It's a new initiative to move undeliverable foodstuffs onto those who need the food the most. My guests are Kate Howe, she's from Indie Hunger Network, Jennifer Vigren, who is from Second Helpings, and John Whitaker, he's from Midwest Food Bank. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Douglas has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Douglas writes, "Just a big thank you from our community. We appreciate your innovation to serve those in need. Many blessings to you." That's got to feel good to hear. I see everybody smiling. Jennifer, you
That's lovely.
We also, it looks like, have a message on Facebook from a listener named Phyllis. Again, if you want to find us on Facebook, you can track us down at No Limits WFYI. Phyllis writes, "Are there educational efforts to educate recipients of food aid on how to best use their food stamps, for instance, to maximize their use?" Everyone's pointing at Kate, so I guess we're going to go to Kate.
One of the programs that the Indie Hunger Network has is a cooking and nutrition education program. We do find that there are folks who don't, learn from mom and dad how to cook and particularly have a hard time cooking on a budget or may not be familiar with eating nutritious foods. So they'll come to a food pantry and there may be beets or there may be turnips, and they don't know how to cook those. They don't know what they taste like, and they're unlikely to take them. And so what we're trying to do is teach folks why you want to eat healthy, how to eat healthy, and then how to prepare those healthy meals. So it's a six-week class, and the participants get a book full of recipes that has some nutrition advice. The courses are taught by a nutrition expert, a cooking expert, and they really leave learning how to buy food on a budget and prepare those healthy meals for their families.
Do you run into the same problems, though, that presumably people do getting the food themselves, that they don't, we've identified transportation, for example, as a challenge. Do they have a difficulty getting to the cooking classes, Kate?
They do sometimes. And so what we're trying to do is teach the classes in places they're already visiting. We are currently teaching a class at an apartment complex on the east side and in their community room. So folks already live there and all they have to do is walk downstairs to attend the class. We've taught classes at community centers where people may be coming for other programming or food pantries. So they're already coming to pick up food and then they can attend a class at the same time. So we're trying to bring the classes to the places where our target audience is already visiting or even where they live.
We are talking about Indie Food Drop. It's a new initiative to move undeliverable foodstuffs on to the people who need them the most. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named David has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, John, and thank you.
Certainly.
I just had a comment for you guys. At one point, I was on food stamps with my family, and we had this problem that I was offered a ambiguous promotion at work, but if I made a little bit more money, I would hit an area where we would lose our food stamps, but I wouldn't be making enough more to cover the food stamps that we lost. So I refused the ambiguous promotion on the basis of I wanted to make sure I could feed my family. Now, thankfully, we're much past that. My wife works out too. We make plenty of money. We're off food stamps. But that was, this was a few years ago, and we really wanted to make sure we could provide for our family.
Thank you very much, David, for calling and sharing your story. Jennifer.
This is, unfortunately, this is something that does happen not just in the food area, but in other benefits as well. It's what's called the benefit gap or a benefit cliff. That at a certain point, there does end up being a cost-benefit analysis that a family has to go through. It is something that, from a public policy's perspective, everyone struggles with. I don't know that there are any easy answers to this issue, but it is something that I think everybody's trying to watch and trying to figure out how do we ease people off of benefits without literally dropping them off of a cliff where there's not an economic reason for them to make that take that promotion that they need to get. It is also where the food pantries and other organizations can step in to provide that support that may or may not have that same kind of benefit eligibility.
So that
issue.
You don't have to make a choice, do I eat or do I pursue an opportunity?
That's right.
David's call kind of illustrates what we were talking about the role of many of these programs before we went to the break. I talked about sort of the immediate logistical challenges for the three of you and your organizations if many of these programs were either to be severely cut or to disappear. Let's put a human face on it now, though. I mean, ultimately, you're not the ones who are going to be most immediately affected. It's going to be the people who need to get the food. What would the impact be? We've talked about the fact that your network can't possibly make the need. What would look like? What would this community look like if those programs were eliminated? I'm going to start with John on that one.
Well, it's going to look like a disaster. And this is what I say frequently to people that, you know, we do disaster relief. It's one of the three prongs that we do for the Salvation Army. We're first in every natural disaster in the lower 48 states when there's a need. And I always say, isn't it a disaster in someone's life when they don't have food, clothing, or shelter? Yet people rush to the scene of a disaster to try to help. And so I personally was at Katrina 2 weeks after it happened with a group of individuals helping to do disaster relief there. And, of course, we all saw, all of America saw the video footage from that. It gets ugly pretty quick. But, you know, it is already impacting us in great ways. The hunger affects every area of our society. Crime is higher because of hunger. Education is not effective. Your economy. Everything is impacted by hunger. So when we have, if we would ever have this apocalyptic decrease of resources in America, it would go downhill pretty quick, John. Mm-hmm.
Jennifer.
You know, John, it's not just about what happens at that moment. It's also about the long-term effects because nutrition is critical to child brain development. Mm-hmm. Nutrition is critical to the ability of the medications and the drugs that we take to keep our bodies healthy. They don't work if we aren't getting the proper nutrition to help them do their job. We're hearing a lot more and more from the medical community about nutrition being a key component of health and medical treatment. So this is not just about the problems we will have at that point in time. We have to think about what the long-term effects are for our society when we have a large portion of our population that is growing up without proper nutrition.
So we've established here already that there are 200,000 people in central Indiana, roughly, who are, and I hate to say, I don't like the term food insecure. I think it's one of those terms that tries to paper over what is really the case. I prefer hungry. People who are hungry or fear being hungry have reasonable fear that they are going to go hungry. How many of those folks, I'm just going to go around. Jennifer, how many people do second helpings serve in the course of a year?
So in the course of a year, we provide 1 million hot, nutritious meals into the community, as well as about more than 1 million additional pounds of food that goes into pantries. That serves tens of thousands of individuals in 85 other not-for-profit agencies.
So assuming these programs went away, just to maintain the status quo we have right now, you'd have to ramp that up to 10 million meals.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's dramatic.
Dramatic. John,
well,
how do you quantify? Do you have numbers that you?
We do have some numbers. You know, we have 320 agencies that are feeding these folks. They tell us that we're feeding 80 to 90,000 people each month. Those are unique individuals. Those are new individuals. A lot of times, hunger, you know, people just need a hand up for a while. So each month they're seeing new people come in that have a new issue. So as soon as you help someone get on their feet, someone else falls, John. So, you know, 80 or 90,000 people each month, $30 million worth of food, and all of our pantries tell us that they need more, that we're barely keeping up with the need.
Kate.
Indy Hunger Network doesn't serve hungry folks directly. Instead, what we do is help the hunger relief organizations collaborate. So,
do you have any idea cumulatively, though, how, or is it just too hard to track because there are too many variables, too many moving parts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have current numbers to share, so I hesitate to throw a number out there. But suffice it to say that we would be working long and hard and still not meeting the need.
We are talking about Indy Food Drop. It's a new initiative to move undeliverable food on to the hungry, the people who need it the most. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Catherine has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, John. Thanks for having me, and good afternoon, panel. My question is actually more locally centered. It breaks my heart every time I go past the Double Eight places that have closed, and I am just curious if anyone has looked into any kind of funding or combination among all of your efforts for this to go into those locations and distribute food there, too, because this is now a food desert in many of these areas where we know Double Eight existed. And thank you for your time, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Off the air. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Catherine.
Sorry, I waited so long. I'm like, whoa.
Not a problem.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for your wonderful show, John.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. Take care. Okay. Kate, I'm presuming you probably would be the best person to answer this.
Sure. There has been a lot of talk about what to do about food deserts. The mayor has a new food policy and program coordinator named Shelley Suttles. I think she's been on this program before, who is working hard.
Almost everyone has been on this program at one time or another.
She's working hard to network and make connections and try to find new solutions. It seems unlikely that a new grocery store will move into the neighborhoods that the Double Eights have moved out of simply because those are neighborhoods living in poverty for the most part, and it's hard to convince a retail grocer to come into a neighborhood that doesn't have a lot of resources. There was a bill in front of the state legislature that would have created healthy food financing for groceries or other convenience stores that want to start selling healthy foods, those sorts of things, and unfortunately it did not make it out of committee this year. I think that group will keep trying to get legislation passed to provide funds for businesses that want to do that kind of work. But we're looking at creative solutions to, there are buying clubs where neighborhoods get together and they buy food straight from the farms, sort of like a CSA, community-supported agriculture program, but focused on the communities that have lost their local grocery store and really led by the people who live there. To think of new ways, alternative ways to bring healthy food into their community where the only choices might be the gas station or the McDonald's.
Are there other places in the country that, because we're not the, we're not the only place in the country that suffers from food deserts. That is sad but true. Where they have been able to take over places like this, the Double Eight is, as Catherine was talking about, and repurpose them in some fashion, a new model where maybe it's a not-for-profit or some sort of hybrid. See, everybody's looking thoughtfully, and it's sort of like when I ask a difficult question in class, no one wants to answer. So
I don't personally know of any. I'm sure there might be some, John, but I always thought it would be a great concept to have a cooperative model in areas like that. I really don't even like the word food desert because you know what I say, and you can see me, but the audience can't. But I have my fist clenched right now, and so a food desert is that.
Yeah,
it's just not willing to help our neighbors. So if everyone would care and feed for their neighbor, then we all would be cared and fed for. I know that's simplistic, but it's really true. So a lot of these problems happen in the community. So when you have a community-based and focused solution that people have buy-in on, then it's more likely to be supported and be successful. So say, for instance, a food cooperative would look like this. So they could buy wholesale products like we do at food banks. A lot of times we have to sometimes buy food that's not donated. A lot of things are like canned goods. You have to buy that. So we typically can get that for $2 a case. Well, you know, you can only buy a couple cans or maybe four cans for $2 at your grocery. So a cooperative could, a not-for-profit cooperative could actually have buying power like that if the community got behind it. And they could have limited selection, staple food items available in these areas in a cooperative model that people bought into. Because, you know, I was in retail grocery 30 years. So you get a retail grocer in those areas, and typically what happens is an average grocery store has about a $42 per customer ring. You get into a needy area or an area that is poverty-stricken, what happens is they're really lower rings with high services, so money orders and other services. So people will typically go into those type of areas and spend $15 to $18. Now, the customer count's high, so you have the store that rings out twice as many customers at a lower rate. It's a no-win situation for the retailer.
So, and because we are getting close on time here, I want to ask first, presumably there's a trucker somewhere who has been listening to this program who has some food. again, if can we give the URL? Kate, I'll start with you on that so that she or he knows how and where to make contact to put this food in the place where it can be used.
IndyFoodDrop.org. If you go to that website, you'll be able to see the different locations, south, west, east, central, you know, where based on where you are, you can pick a location. You can pick it by the quantity of food you have to donate, the type of product. Some places can take more frozen foods than others, for instance. And their phone numbers, contact information, and people are available right now to take that food.
And then the next question, real quickly, is because we mentioned that of the 31% of the food that goes to waste, the bulk of it is from consumers after it's made. Is there a way or any plan to plug in those of us who say, okay, I got some food that I would like to drop off and have be used? Is that possible, or is that just not a model? Real quickly, Jennifer.
If you've got fresh produce, if you're a gardener and who grows too much produce, by all means, you can take it to your local food pantry. You can bring it to Second Helpings, to a food bank. We'll all be happy to take it. If you've got prepared food, you need to share with your neighbor, and take it to the office and share it with others, as opposed to bringing it to the pantries.
I'd like to thank my guests, Kate Howe, Jennifer Vigren, and John Whitaker, for a lively conversation. Welcome everybody back next Tuesday when we're going to be talking about the state legislature. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.